I tend to have a difficulty understanding where folks are coming from when they say that they don't see color. And even after we coach them, we train them, they'll start to understand it. But for me, as a person who's not white, I had trouble figuring out what white guilt feels like. I had trouble figuring out why someone could just say, oh, I don't see color, and think that that is more equitable than acknowledging our differences and acknowledging the real ramifications and consequences of our individualized upbringings and identities.
Welcome to Queer Hustle, where we talk to the hottest up-and-coming queer entrepreneurs about growing businesses, creating dream lifestyles, and taking care of each other. Your host, Michelle Coyle, sits down to work together to explore what's possible when you approach business with full authenticity. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Queer Hustle podcast. I'm Roberto Musso, back again taking over from Michelle, and I'm so honored to be joined by Dania Abu-Talib.
I'm Dania. I am wildly excited to get to some topics about queer entrepreneurship, about upbringing, about societal expectations with Roberto, who I've actually, fun fact, known since high school, like early high school. Yeah, we grew up in the same town. So it's a pleasure to reconnect with you, and I can't wait to get into it.
It is a pleasure to have you guys. And let's just say, yeah, so I've known Dania for a really long time and then we lost touch. Basically, like, it was like the fall kind of around when I started this job working for Michelle, working for Queer Hustle, all of this. I got this invite to like a Facebook page from Dania, and then I checked it out. You know, we've been promoting queer entrepreneurship on here, but I haven't known someone so much to do so in my personal life. So to see someone at my age doing this, I was so impressed. Once I actually found out everything you were doing, I was floored. And I was like, anyone can be doing this. And this, you're proof to show it, and you're proof that you can be successful, and you're proof that you can be do well at it. And it's awesome. So yeah, I'm super excited to get to talk to you. And do you want to actually, I'm hyping it up so much, I feel like we need to just go ahead and explain.
So PIP Collective is a diversity, equity, and inclusion implementation firm. So essentially, to delve into the rationale behind why I decided to found PIP and eventually brought on a dear friend, Taylor, so we co-founded it, was in our past experiences, while we both majored in women, gender, and sexuality studies and had our stints in African American studies and American studies, when we went out into the world, we found that we were incredibly dismayed with how other people were approaching DEI training, coaching, etc. And all that's to say is it was either horribly lackluster or it was non-existent entirely. And so for a personal anecdote, I was working at a fairly large consulting firm a couple years prior, and I noticed that as Black Lives Matter resurgence began galvanizing once more when George Floyd was murdered by police officers, I said, what is my company doing about this? Turns out they were against doing much of anything. There were internal emails telling diverse staff to respect employees who had police spouses, and they refused to even acknowledge Black Lives Matter. They refused to hire a diversity officer and accept all the free deluge of resource that was coming in. And so I felt I couldn't continue being someone who is Palestinian, someone who is queer, someone who says that I stand by my ethos and all that I do while continuing to work somewhere like that. And so arguably, Roberto, during the best time, during COVID, I quit my job, moved back across the country, and it was all step one. I had to return to my roots, and my roots were based in entrepreneurship. And so I had to start putting some pieces together, and eventually PIP was born. We just want to do it differently. We aim to do it differently. And based on our experiences, based on literature, one-off trainings where you check a box and you get in a room for 90 minutes a year does not make you fluent in DEI, does not make you aware of much, and it's not actionable. And that's all that PIP aims to rectify.
This is so necessary, especially in the corporate world, because I think I was in a similar boat of like, I was getting all this liberal education and like what I was taking all these women and gender studies classes in college. And I was like, I think the world's changing and people are really recognizing these issues. And then you get into the real world and it's not always like that. I remember that was a huge part around the time that the George Floyd protests were coming up. That was around the time when I got to shift jobs, but it was a huge no to me to see like, oh, my old company wasn't putting out statements like this, you know? And it tells you, especially as a person of color at your company, it really has to put into perspective, like, how much do actual issues like this matter to other places. You know what I mean? And especially they have me here, but what am I to them if they're not gonna fight for me and like my rights?
Precisely. I think at the baseline, I was doing my full-time job of being a consultant. And then I was also heralded as this person that was attempting to help bolster our employee resource groups and our DEI efforts, not getting compensated for that. And it's like, okay, I really am just someone that is placed on this performative pedestal because I'm brown. They just don't want to shell out on someone who has this experience or even pay some of the employees that do have that experience for their hard-earned work. And so PIP was born, and now I can say that my soul has been cleansed, has been regalvanized in pursuing all that I care about and all that matters to me. And I'm doing it with an incredible team, and I couldn't be happier.
It makes me so happy to see you happy because I can see that on you. Like, I can see fully just you kind of got into this job, and it's at the same point you want to like make sure that you're doing your job and you're doing the best you can, but it shouldn't be the burden on you to like bear the weight of, oh, this is what we should be doing, and this is how you can be more inclusive and more equitable. That should be just obvious things. So, but it's not obvious. And especially in the world we live in, especially considering it's such a white proclaimed world. And I think especially that's something that like I didn't pay too much mind to enough growing up. I think there was things you didn't know, you know, because it was like almost being portrayed as a truth of, oh, well, this is just the way the world is. Like things don't, it's fair for everybody, but when it's not, and there's actively things that are like playing against you.
Exactly. I mean, it comes down to basic empathy in my terms and in PIP's ethos. I think I tend to have a difficulty understanding where folks are coming from when they say that they don't see color. And even after we coach them, we train them, they'll start to understand it. But for me, as a person who's not white, I had trouble figuring out what white guilt feels like. I had trouble figuring out why someone could just say, oh, I don't see color, and think that that is more equitable than acknowledging our differences and acknowledging the real ramifications and consequences of our individualized upbringings and identities. So it took a lot of learning and unlearning for me as well, as someone who doesn't have the experience of being white, for example, to be able to consult, coach, and train other white people.
Well, and that's a huge thing, is I think a lot of people were almost raised, or a lot of white people specifically were raised to say, I don't see color. And that was their whole viewpoint of, and I am not racist because I don't see it. But, you know, I'll say, I see you. It's not a question. It's just the matter of like, I see you and I see your experience. I don't necessarily see your experience as much as I'm listening to you. And that's why I'm so excited for PIP. And I'm so excited for what you have coming up with PIP. So go ahead and talk about a little bit about like how you see PIP growing, exactly where you want the company to be.
Sure. I mean, at this juncture, we are close to our 1-year mark. Coming from a background of project management and agile frameworks, we've grown a lot. And I have to say, other members on my team, my co-founder, they didn't come from an entrepreneurial background. I did. And it's wildly challenging and invigorating and enchanting watching them grow as well as just watching us continue to achieve what we are. I mean, at this point, we have some incredible clients within our portfolio that we love to work with, and they are incredible organizations that really do stand by what they mean and what they say. The Georgetown School of Medicine, like Lighthouse Labs, which is an entrepreneurship and startup accelerator in Richmond. It's incredible to partner with these organizations that I continue to grow up knowing about and not necessarily ever see these paths intersect. And then one day, boom, I have this startup this diversity collective that's a startup, and suddenly we're chatting with the dean of the Office of Diversity at the med school. So I've always seen myself as a visionary and idealist, and I've learned a lot over the years how to grow, organize, and execute and achieve. And I think that going forward, what I would love to continue pursuing is inducing this revolutionary paradigm shift within big organizations like the Academy for movies, like media management companies for artists. What if all artists had DEI training and DEI coaching? What if they didn't have to fear PR backlash because they actually knew what they cared about and they pursued social impact development and causes that aligned with that? So what I'm most interested in, to answer the original question, is continuing to rile up some feathers, to shake some things up, and see if we can induce a paradigm shift across the rest of other industries.
That's awesome. No, and that's huge, because I feel like that's exactly the problem. Especially in Hollywood, you kind of see like artists will like be almost be afraid to commit to something. But then now I feel like it's almost become the norm of, oh no, you need to take a stand or else you have this platform. But it's like, you'll also find out years after something happened, oh, I wasn't treated fairly and I didn't get to speak on that at the time. And that's not fair to anyone. And that's the thing, is like, it should be a safe space to speak up. I don't think a lot of places were born and it's okay to speak up about things. And it's okay to say, this isn't how I feel. This doesn't align with my value. And that's especially another level of queer people where like, I feel like we have for so long been told, oh, our struggle isn't as serious as other people, or like, it's almost been diminished to where we'll have our own personality and our own lives. And then like, we kind of have to like turn the switch whenever we are in other spaces so we feel safe. And especially, I think you probably related to that a lot growing up in Culpeper, where I did too, because it's just like, it's not the norm. So I do kind of want to hear a little bit more about your background too. Let's talk about what it was like being gay in Culpeper, or your entrepreneurial background.
Certainly. To circle back to the one point you made about how the plight of queer folks has been diminished, it has. And that's because it has also been very whitewashed, and because we're ignoring Black trans women, we're ignoring Asian lesbians, right? We think, oh, well, you're white and you're gay. Like, come on, you're not actually facing that much. But really, it's ignoring sort of an intersectional array of identities within the LGBTQ plus community. And I think it's detrimental to continue upholding diversity and DEI as solely a racial initiative, because it's not. It's an incredibly large component. But what we do at PIP is we start to acknowledge the spheres of power people have and hold. How can we start transforming those and look at it as an anti-oppressive framework rather than solely an anti-racist or an anti-homophobic framework?
See, and I love what you just said there, where it's like, it's queering capitalism almost. Hearing that, and especially hearing that from a boss, like that is so important. And so important to hear someone acknowledge that. So it's huge. And it's something that I didn't even know if I could ever find.
Absolutely. And I think in the name of power and bosses and queer bosses, Roberto, do you know how many LGBTQ CEOs there are amidst the Fortune 500 out CEOs?
I don't know. I'm going to guess pretty the number small.
It's horrendous. It's only 3 out of 500. I mean, Beth Ford from Land of Lakes, Tim Cook from Apple, and Jim Fitterling from Dow Chemical Company. It's only 3. And those are only the people who are out. What about the people who don't feel comfortable enough because of all the capitalistic oppressive frameworks to even come out? Who knows if they would be fired, if they would get severe backlash from the public? It's so delicately interconnected. And I agree, we have to start talking about background and upbringing, because that's really where a lot of people start to formulate some of their paradigms about society that do endure throughout their lives.
Right. Because we're just kind of getting out of that generation where it was like, you can't be gay or else you have AIDS. They were kind of like leading the framework, is what I was understanding. You know, a part of also making sure that there's multiple faces to the queer movement. It's okay, what did we have in the 90s? Will and Grace, you know, like that is like just 4 white people in New York City being like, oh yeah, it's cool to be gay, it's chill. That, at least in my mind, I feel like it's perpetuating many stereotypes that for some ways it was good because it was almost like giving exposure, but you know, in a lot of ways it kind of still kept people in these boxes of what you had to be, especially over the paradigm shift over like the past couple of years. You'll see, like you said, we ignore like Black trans women. I don't know if you've ever watched Pose. It's something that I got into.
Absolutely. Yeah. Season 3 is coming out in a couple months.
The last season. I'm actually very upset about it. But I got into that recently and I only got like 4 episodes in so far because it's very emotional and heavy shows. And it's, do you ever feel that? Like you just kind of like really want to relax and like turn off. So you're just kind of like, okay.
Yeah, you definitely have to understand there's always going to be trauma in the world. There's always going to be a movement that you can back. And I encourage and invite everyone to do so to the extent that they're comfortable and they can, right? So if something's triggering you, turn the TV off, go take a walk, read a book. If you can't make it to the next protest, that's okay. Like donate where you can, you know, read up on some literature. I think it's incredibly important to acknowledge how impactful it can be to rest and heal.
You know, and I actually love that you said that, because I feel like that's another thing we're seeing so often is like, as the world gets more political and we're more just like, speak up about it. It's almost like a performative wokeness of, oh, I have to do this. So therefore, no, but it's like, you need to show up and you need to be present and you need to be engaged and you need to be learning and you need to have learned in order to teach. And I feel like that's also where I'm so excited about what you're doing, because it's so just like, I know that you're someone who's done the work and you're someone who's lived that work. And it's, as you said, you've literally done the work and weren't getting paid for it. So you know what? You might as well get paid for it. And I love that you're out there and you're getting yours. It's so cool to see.
Thank you, Roberto. I think it's incredible to be able to have the opportunity to circle back and connect with folks. I mean, Culpeper. Let's talk about Culpeper, right?
What was it like growing up for you in Culpeper?
I'd be remiss if I didn't chat about the intersection of race, religion, and sexuality, because growing up Middle Eastern, growing up Muslim, and also having moved from Northern Virginia, which is a very liberal area, to Culpeper. Also, let me tell you the story in a high level of how we moved. My family decided we wanted a bigger house at the end of my fourth grade tenure, picked a house, and then neglected to tell me and my brother that it was an hour away. So I was like, I'll see y'all later to my friends at the playground. And then we moved. And that's why I have, you know, like trust issues now. But, you know, that's to be rectified elsewhere. Anyway, so growing up in Culpeper, it was a very conservative area. Also growing up in a more conservative Muslim household, it was not okay to be gay. It wasn't even in my conception. I didn't even understand what it meant. Like, all I understood was to be gay was to be a man who dressed in women's clothes and then would be made fun of for it. Because that's how it was portrayed in a lot of Middle Eastern soaps as well. And so I didn't have those role models. I didn't know anyone who was gay. I just didn't know. And as I discovered Tumblr.com, that was certainly formative in my knowledge. What, you had Tumblr, right? Every gay kid had Tumblr.
Did I? Not quite.
What?
We'll get into me in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was formative. And I think that that just speaks to bring in some academic perspectives. That brings in the critical notion of how intellectualism is really starting to fray, I think, society's understanding of what is legitimate and what is not. Because for something to be intellectual, it has to be in difficult words, it has to be published. But who has access to upbringings where they can just pay for a tutor to teach them all of these things and then get published and spend years not getting paid and just writing books? That's why we have to seriously uplift local activists and uplift people who disregard and disavow all these institutions. All that's to say is Tumblr is incredible. It's life-saving, it's life-changing. And that was really what got me through high school. I didn't come out. I remember I went to one party. It was one that I threw for Halloween or something. And people thought that because I had rainbow-colored jello there, that was me coming out. And I was like, whoa, let's slow down. I mean, you're right, but like, let's slow down. And I just stayed that way until I went to college at the University of Virginia. I entirely reshaped and redirected the course of my life and came out, which we can also chat about, because whether you come out or not does not impact your validity as an LGBTQ plus person. And it's entirely formed who I am today.
Queer Hustle is sponsored by BGSD Strategies. BGSD Strategies helps queer-owned businesses scale past the $10 million revenue mark and more. To learn more, visit www.bgsdstrategies/slay.
I love hearing your story and like remembering just like what it was like growing up in Culpeper and having the pressures of like, but it's so crazy to hear what you're saying, and like also to hear how different it was, but how similar it was to me. Because I'll say, like, and we should probably clarify for this audience. Basically, Culpeper is this very like middle of Virginia kind of like, it is close enough to Nova. Like Daniel said, it's an hour away, but it's still like, it's different. There's farms. I live next to horses, you know, it's that kind of town still. I feel like it's weird to think, because I grew up in this system where it's almost like, entire majority from like a presenting space, right? We have like, my parents were Catholic. I would like go to church every Sunday, go to Sunday school, you know, and I have this like good upbringing, but at the same time, it's like, okay. So it kind of how you were talking about, like in your household, it was so not something that was okay. It was not something that was discussed. I remember there was one time in like fourth grade, someone was like, oh, I can't be your friend anymore because yeah, people think we're gay. And I was like, what does that even mean? And they're just like, oh, it's when you guys are a couple, like a man and a girl. Okay. And like, wait, hold on. No, not even what's the problem. I was like, that's not possible. That's not something that's insane. Yeah. But it's like, when I think back, like actually psychologically, it's like, I was at least 5 or 3. I was like having like memories of guys and stuff like that, or like just thinking of them differently, how I imagine guys would, like, we're typically thinking of girls and girls were typically thinking of guys. And then I'll say Tumblr wasn't exactly MySpace. MySpace was like YouTube, and there's one underground reality show game place called RTV Games. Some people were like really out, and it's what you said. It's some people were, it doesn't necessarily not affirm you as like a member of the LGBTQI. It's so wild to think this was like this whole community pretty much just like girls and gays online that I interacted with growing up.
Thank you for sharing, Roberto. When did that transition for you, I suppose? Because now I see you as the pinnacle of confidence when it comes to sexuality and sexual orientation, and you exude it in every pore. So can you chat a little bit about when that transformed for you?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. If I'm honest, it's not like a total, like, I'm definitely confident. I'm definitely like confident in my sexuality still. I mean, I am. That's not to say I'm not. And that's not to say I don't feel like I try and exude confidence. But I think it's almost, I think, a psychological trigger for people of like, it's, and I explain this a lot to my friends. I think it's a privilege I have of like this white guy confidence that we've almost learned to like just believe is true. I can fake it really well. I can fake confidence really well because I can say things very affirmatively. And I think that's just something that, you know, I don't know that everyone can, especially everyone in the LGBTQI community. I think that's honestly where a lot of it comes from. When did it really switch for me personally? I'll be honest. I think that's another thing that I think a lot of queer people don't talk about is because it's not working out for you in dating all your life growing up, you're almost like led to believe you're not attractive or you're not confident and you can't be sexual and you are like not someone desirable or anything like that. So, and especially when there's not a lot of out kids around you, or there's just simply not a lack of queer kids, it doesn't feel like there's a lot going on. So I think I needed to feel confident a lot with the stability of my network, my friend group. I have great friends from Call Pepper. Absolutely, I do. It was different though, because it's like they had to know me as one person, and I almost didn't feel super confident in the person I loved growing up in college. College was very rough for me. I didn't go to the University of Virginia. I went to Virginia Tech, and that was like almost like Call Pepper 2.0. And I think that's part of the reason why I wanted it, if I'm honest, because it reminded me of like a small town of home. I know, and that sounds crazy to say, but it's true. And a lot of my friends from like, it was like my best friends from home were going there, 3 of them. So I was like, this is perfect. I'm going to go. And I went, and I didn't have a bad time. I loved it. I'm appreciative for it. But, you know, I did learn how to be myself, because I made friends and I knew that I was making friends for people who loved me how I was. Because I was out in college. I wasn't sure if I was going to do that right away. I kind of came out late into high school when finally someone was like, oh, this guy thinks you're cute. I was like, great, I do too. Okay, like we'll just take care of that. It's like I finally had the confidence to talk about it with people. And then couldn't decide what I wanted to do at college. And there was like the first college party I was at, someone was like, you're gay, right? I was like, yes. And probably a lot smoother than that, it seemed, because there was, you know, beverages. But at the same point, yeah, so that's kind of the point. I was like, well, I guess you can't escape it. So just live yourself and see what happens. And I'm really glad I made that decision. But yeah, it was a ride. And also coming out with our parents back home still, like, wasn't the easiest thing. I think literally over the summer, my dad was just kind of like, wait, you know, Roberto like had a boyfriend, talking to my mom. And that is the nice thing. It's easier. At least there's like some generation where that, you know, will support you. I found that with my siblings. How did you feel like that with your brother? How was that for you?
It was an entirely radical differentiation between with my parents. It's still not really acknowledged with them. It's like, it just doesn't exist. So I almost regressed in the sense that it was something to be made fun of, to now it's just almost your situation where it just doesn't exist. With my siblings, I mean, they're all accepting, empowering, excited. They've met partners in the past. It's an entirely different ballgame there. It's like you said, I feel like we wouldn't be in this business, in this space, unless we were optimists at heart, because we are investing in the future and we are investing in the hope that the next generation and the generation thereafter will continue understanding what it means to be human and providing space for everyone to bloom to the fullest extent of themselves.
And it's such a matter of actually teaching people. And that's the thing. It does like almost become a burden where you're like, oh, well, I'm teaching in my everyday life, like just like in having conversations with people. It's like, for instance, we even talked about this a little bit before. Like if I'm ever in a room of straight guys, like, oh, like fear of God. But that is something that like I'll have conversations with straight guys. And it's, I like that you said that about being like not necessarily optimistic. It's like, a lot of my friends, I'll be like, I think you're coming from a place of like, everyone is intrinsically good and everyone isn't, will change. I don't think people are necessarily intrinsically good. I think it's almost something you have to learn. It's learned behavior. Especially I can see where like a white guy, for instance, would think that, or a straight white guy would think that of like, people are going to be naturally good because they've been fine to me overall, you know, but it's like, I think when you go in with like more of a wary eye, you have to really question like what learned behaviors will we have to break down going into this?
Speaking of learned behaviors, and as we transition into chatting about more specifically entrepreneurship, that was one of the first ventures I conceptualized and wanted to pursue. So again, you said this a couple of minutes ago where you were chatting about how we as queer kids didn't necessarily get the experience of having like a first relationship or a first heartbreak at the time I think we should have. So it's almost like we were catching up in our adulthood. And so I found when I went to college and I started having queer relationships and engaging in them, I found I didn't know how to practice boundary setting. I didn't know what was okay, what wasn't. Some of my behavior was not preferred. We just didn't have that learning. We didn't have that teaching. We didn't have the societal approval. Like if you saw TV growing up and even now at most times, most shows are either queer baiting or the queer characters die. And so there was just no frame of reference for me. So going to an entrepreneurial background, that was one of the first friendships I wanted to create. It was specifically not necessarily therapy, but some form of like therapy, but also like relationship coaching aimed at queer adolescents. I just think that that is so necessary. And even a decade later, it's still necessary. I wish I had that instead of having to endure the pain and the cringiness of what I endured and what I exhibited. So if anyone out there as a queer hustler, please feel free to start that business and dedicate it to me and all the queer youth, because I will definitely champion all that you do.
Danya, I love that. And I think that was something really special in what you said. You said, if you don't, it just popped in my mind. Like, if you don't see the space for yourself, this is a Miley Cyrus quote, but I'm sure someone did it way before because it can't be like entirely original. She was just like, if you don't see the seat in your, like at the table for yourself, make your own table, you know? And that's the cool, awesome thing about your entrepreneurship experience is like, you actually made your own table. And you made your own table surfaced around like, oh, how can we actual big corporations include people at the table and include that seat? This doesn't have to be like something where it's like, it's not already learned, because, you know, I don't know. It was really beautiful what you said.
Precisely. I think as we entertain the metaphorical aspect of it, people who do DEI training, I mean, it's a $6 billion industry if we want to speak in big terms. But we're not rolling in dough because we truly believe in our mission and our ethos in that DEI generic one-off trainings don't work. And while there are other companies that may provide a 90-minute training for $6,000, for example, it's just not something that we do. It's not something that we offer without also imbuing and equipping those folks with longevity, with actionable strategic plans, with implementation steps and roadmaps to ensure that they are doing this authentically and it will be long lasting. Because otherwise it goes against everything we believe. And while we might not reap some performative benefit, it makes us sleep better at night. And I think that that's one of the most important things for entrepreneurs to consider. It's not necessarily glamorous. It's not really the most ideal situation at times, most times, but is it going to be something that aligns with your soul the most? And I found that in PIP.
See, and I think that's so important to feel this like aligning of your soul. Because we talked a little bit about this. I can't even remember if it was like on this call or like a little bit before this, but it's this cognitive dissonance of almost feeling like you're not your same self everywhere you go. And so when you find something that aligns with your soul and that you're really happy to work for, you work at it and you work to get good at it. And that's beautiful. I'm so glad you have that. I'm so happy to see you, because I think you're someone that a lot of people always looked at and you knew you would do well, you know, and you knew you would do awesome, exceptional things. But I don't think like necessarily we would see it would look like this. You know what I mean? And I love to hear that, like, you're doing well and you're like really killing it, but at the same time doing something that makes you really happy. And I think not only is that really special, it's so special to have this young in your career where it's like you only have years to grow.
Hopefully. No, I appreciate that, Ro. It was a long journey. At UVA, the entrepreneurial community consisted of 14 white guys and one black man. I was trying to figure out what my journey would be. And the reason I actually first got involved in an actual startup was my first year, I got diagnosed with prediabetes because of my diet and my stress coping. And to give you insight on my personality, rather than adhere to the strict diet that my doctor prescribed, I was just crying into my Froyo with one of my mentors at the time, Alex Zaretta, who's a big, big entrepreneurship mentor. Why don't we just make something? And we were just like spitballing and I was just like, M&M's falling out of my mouth. I'm like, I can't give it up. But he was like, actually, I know a group in the med school that's working on glycemic spikes. And I feel like this perspective might actually propel them forward. The team disbanded. Let's see if you can't rile something up. And then that eventually re-galvanized and became Sugarway, which was the first startup that I spearheaded. And it was essentially a modified probiotic pill that aimed at reducing glycemic spikes in people with type 1 diabetes. So you eat a donut or you eat three like I do. You take this pill that costs 36 cents. And then the amount of sugar your body absorbs is that of an apple rather than a donut. And that was my first experience in managing teams, in pitching. Eventually, we garnered over 70K in funding, and it was incredible. But at the end of the day, I graduated, and there's something to be said for the fact that I have not connected with the team since. And I think that all ties back into really doing what aligns with your soul. Even if something is glamorous, even if something will induce revolutions, I think it's important that you put your all behind it and ensure that it's just what you want to do every day when you wake up.
I'm sorry, guys. My jaw's been on the floor. Wait, Daniel, you mean to fully say you had a business already in college and like fully worked? That's incredible.
It was, I wouldn't call it a business. It was, and I'm not diminishing myself here. It really was me and then a rotating team of a lab manager and then any given four undergrads at a time. We were just trying to figure out what the hell was happening. Could this happen? And at the end of the day, not much of a product came to fruition because you just need to have full-time dedication to something like that. But what did come out of it and has persisted is my enticement, my love, my draw to the entrepreneurial community and the entrepreneurial spirit, which I think is really what differentiated me in my route towards founding PIP and pursuing entrepreneurial ventures.
See, I love that. And I love to hear you like actively like pursuing all your entrepreneurial ventures. And guys, let me tell you, Dania is just like this, where it's like, I've talked to her for an hour now on the phone and like, literally, she's like, oh yeah, well, I have this other business too. And I was like, wait, you're literally, when? And I'm not even talking about the one that you just mentioned. It's, you're just pulling businesses out of a hat and it's amazing. And it's all stuff that it sounds like matters to you. And it's a struggle where you saw this wasn't there in the market. So you were like, I'm going to make it. And I'm going to make it because I know this affects someone and I know I could have used that.
Absolutely. I think to circle back to how we started this off, as someone who considers myself a very futuristic thinker, the one phrase, Ro, that I despise above many others is, no, that's the way we've always done it. Or no, like this is fine as it is. I think we should always seek to reinvent the wheel. I think that there is always more to be discovered. There's always more to be innovated. And just because, you know, the car worked, why don't we pursue electric cars? Why don't we pursue solar paneled cars? Those have induced such an innovative revolution in society, and that was reinventing the wheel. So I think there's always something to be done as long as there are people who are willing to work for it and are willing to rectify that problem.
Right. And it's all about finding the people and finding the people who are going to stick up and get up from the lunch table and be like, no, we're not going to do that. I don't know. Something in what you said about like, no, it reminded me of that one, the one High School Musical song where it's like, stick to the stuff, you know.
In the cafeteria, the status quo.
Yes.
Song? Yes.
Yes. And they're like, stick to the status quo. It's like, you got to find people who aren't going to stick to the status quo and who are fully going to like get the fuck up and like actually help you.
Yes. Yes. And that's why I believe in the power of manifesting positive energies into your life, which is how I came back to hanging out with you. And so I feel like all of that being said, it's the queer hustlers in your life that really propel you forward. And you're one of them, bro.
You know, I know I've like basically like bowed down to you this whole time. You are one of those too. So I'm so glad that this has brought us back together and that like we're fully, you know, it's like the thing is like, it's not only has this brought us back together, I don't see you leaving now. You know what I mean? Where I love it. Like, I'm so happy to like be back in touch with you and actually like get to be keeping up with you and watching this as like you're growing. And like, you know, I'll see you. I know you have 3 businesses or 2 businesses or however many we have. And I'm so excited to see you at your 50th business or so. And something we do always ask here on Queer Hustle, how has being queer helped your business? And what would you say to people who fully come in and just are like, oh, well, being queer doesn't have anything to do with business? And I feel like we've talked about this a lot where it's like, yeah, the intersectionality matters.
So I appreciate you asking that. And I think it's an incredible segue into transitioning off and continuing on with all the great things that we put our minds to. I think one of the biggest things is not to victimize or bring up trauma, but there's just so much that goes in with being a queer Muslim. Like, there's just so much adversity and so much pain there. And I think having had those difficult and painful experiences have propelled me forward in ways that I don't believe others get the opportunity to do. It's just because acknowledging the power and the confidence that I hold, having traversed those mountains of difficulty and pain, and acknowledging that at many times I was the only person that was keeping me afloat, and getting through to the other side showed me and illuminated to me that truly there are systems of power continuing to seek to disempower me and people like me. But I don't care. I'm going to continue pursuing all that matters to me. And that's that. So I think one of the biggest things that I can invite people to do is sit down with yourself and give yourself some credit. I mean, especially in an age where it's funny or favorable to diminish yourself, I'd invite you to disregard that at all times that you can, because who knows what opportunity might be waiting for you around the corner. You might get an opportunity to chat with Ro on Queer Hustle. So.
Perhaps you might. And if you are, let me know, please. You are awesome, Dania Boutaleb. I hope you know. I hope you fully know. So this has been a pleasure. Where can people find you if they want to keep up with Pip?
Absolutely. I love LinkedIn. So just Dania Boutaleb and then pip-collective.com. If you ever want to chat about anything, whether it be Kafka, supernovas, gardening, or DEI, just let me know. I would love to do so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. And to everybody listening, I hope you enjoyed this podcast and we will catch you next time. Thanks for listening to Queer Hustle. To read the full show notes for this episode, which include a summary, timestamps, and any links mentioned in this episode, please visit michellecoyle.com/podcast. There, you'll find the information from this episode and any past episodes. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating and a review at ratethispodcast.com/queerhustle. Until we meet again next week, go out there and let it shine.